This is Steve Heller with a Core 77 broadcast.
As founder and president of Kid Robot, Paul Budnitz has surfed the rising crest of the limited edition art toy wave. Not only is he the co-designer of Kid Robot's signature Dunny and Money toys, he also art directs, co-designs, and collaborates with many of today's leading plastic and vinyl toy artists, including Dalek, Frank Kozik, and Gary Baseman. The son of a nuclear physicist and a social worker, Budnitz grew up in Berkeley, California. By the age of 15, he was writing computer code for video games and safety analysis programs for nuclear power plants, if you can believe it. He studied photography, sculpture, and film at the Yale University, graduating with honors in fine art in 1990. He has authored a score of screenplays and wrote and directed the feature-length films 93 Million Miles from the Sun and Ultraviolet. In the mid-90s, Budnitz owned Big, a fashion label that created modified vintage clothing for the international market. In 1997, he founded Minidisco.com, a digital recording website for which he wrote back-end software, enabling him to run the multi-million dollar business out of his home. In 2002, he founded Kid Robot. In just 5 years, Kid Robot has grown from a single online store to a multi-million dollar creative corporation that runs three store galleries in the United States, in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York City, and there are more coming in the U.S. and around the world. Over the past 2 years, he's added apparel to Kid Robot, a line that is growing exponentially with scores of new products planned for this year alone. Kid Robot has been included in the Cooper Hewitt Triennale, and recently selected pieces were included in the permanent design collection at the Museum of Modern Art. I recently spent time in the toy and hoodie-crammed Kid Robot offices in downtown Manhattan, talking with the designer-entrepreneur about the state of the burgeoning art toy and apparel design business, and Kid Robot's major contributions to it. So we're here in your office, and it's filled with toys and posters and stickers, and it must be a dream place for anybody who's just come out of school to come and say, I'm working at a job in an office, but they can put everything that they have in their room around here. How did you start this place?
I was directing an animated film, and I'd been working as a filmmaker for a while. At the same time, I'd been sort of obsessively starting and running my own businesses. So I had a sort of geeky website where we built our own microphones and recording equipment for music and for filmmaking, and I was really into making my own films, and I did that with a lot of equipment that I built myself, whether it was a computer system I built myself. And so during the process of sort of building this animated film, which is a very odd kind of animated art film, I became totally obsessed with these toys I saw coming out of China and Japan. But I think even more than the toys, I was really struck by the aesthetic. And it wasn't really about the toys for me, because I'm not essentially a collector. Even though we have, you know, thousands of people, I guess, now that collect our stuff, I'm the funny thing is, I'm really not one of them. I just really, really, really like the flatness of the characters. I like the bright colors. It just really resonated with sort of the stuff I was already doing.
So you've become a conduit for these things, but you've also created and allowed others to create for you. What determines what you put into the marketplace? What determines what you embrace?
The simplest answer is it's sort of what's needed. In a way, what was really revolutionary about Kid Robot for me, what was the breakthrough for me, was when I realized I could really collaborate and that there was an art to collaboration, and I began to develop that. So as opposed to my earlier projects where it was really about what I was doing, I just sort of let go. I let go of having credit for what I did. I let go of needing to be the one who made everything. And out of all that, in fact, I've made a lot of the stuff that we sell, but I really opened the door to letting whatever came in. And so we have a very defined aesthetic. We really know what we're doing. And at the same time, we just let people in and let people in. And in a way, it becomes a collaboration between all these amazing artists and morphing them into the aesthetic that I hold here.
Well, you've made this new form. It comes out of pop art on one hand and illustration on the other, and an earlier incarnation of toys before they were vinyl. You've put all this stuff together and you've made a new aesthetic. How would you define that aesthetic?
I can't really define it. For me, like, I can see it. It's bright and it's flat and it's plastic. And to me, like, it was embracing plasticness.
But how does it differ
I mean, it's obvious how it differs, but how would you say it differs from mainstream toys, which are also bright and plastic, but don't have the same panache, don't have the same veneer?
Well, I think a lot of ways that the stuff we make is emotionally more complex. So there may be one or more things going on at the same time. Like as my friends at Double Robot say really well, like their work is really about a little cuteness and a little blackness. So there's more than one thing happening at once. When you're kids, especially if you've had kids, you see that like a child, he's hungry and then he gets upset and his whole life is about being upset. And he's got really no control over that. And as we mature, we start to feel more than one thing at the same time, like I love you and I hate you at the same time. And truly mature people can actually sustain two feelings at once and not overwhelmed by that. And what I think is in a lot of the stuff we create is two or more things that are kind of maybe don't normally fit together in let's say child's toys or child's art, but as an adult it totally resonates for us. So there's always something. I mean, even if you look at the logo of our company, the Kid Robot character has a bit of a Mona Lisa smile. Like, you can't tell if he's smiling and he's really cute, and if I put a flower in his hand, he looks really cute, or if he's grimacing, in which case, you know, if you put a crowbar in his hand, he looks like he's about to break into your car.
Did you design the logo?
With Tristan Eaton.
And where did Kid Robot, the name, come from? I mean, there's Kid there, so we're presuming it's for kids.
Right. It just actually came out of... And this isn't very romantic, but it came out of me making a very long list of names that I thought might work out and buying the web domain from someone for $250 because it was available. It was a good name, though.
With Kid Robot, when you're producing toys, when you're producing the Mooney toy, for example, do you have an idea of who the audience is? Or is this just, we're creating, we're throwing it out, and we'll catch whoever falls into the net?
It's both. This is a business. So I'm really into selling things. I mean, part of really what the artwork... I mean, what this business runs on is creating stuff, selling it out, and then having to create something totally new every time, because most of what we do is limited edition. And that includes the fashion side of the business now. It's seasonal. So when something's gone, it's gone forever, and we have to come up with something totally new. For me, it's like we're definitely thinking, you know, will this sell? Does this sell? This is no question. But at the same time, it's got to fit into what we're doing. And as far as, like, there's a sort of motto that we use, which is the question is it undeniable? And if it's undeniable, we'll sell it. And I really will take a project all the way to the end and kill it, even if we spend a lot of money on it, if it's not working. Because it's not worth it. It'll hurt us in the end.
Do you go through the traditional methods? Do you test? Do you bring people in here and throw them in a room and see whether they're in love or whether they just sit blankly at the wall?
No. I mean, the thing is, again, if you look at collaboration, it's also a process that I use to run this company. So there are almost 40 people now in this office. And they used to be 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, there were 7. Since the beginning, really brought in really great people. And part of that opening process was realizing that I hire incredibly talented, incredibly, I think, creative people who are working at a job that doesn't suit them. And I put them in a job at Kid Robot that seems to suit them, but that they maybe haven't done before. And so everyone here has a secondary responsibility, everybody, which is to sit in creative meetings at different times when they're needed. So Nicole, who does our promotions, is like an incredible toy collector, and she collects like toys I would never touch, frankly. Like, she's like probably the foremost Simpsons toy collector in the United States. She lives in a small apartment. It's wall-to-wall toys. And then there's like Chad, who used to work at Moss, the design store, knows everything about modern design and like high design, and like he reads every magazine. And then there's this guy Mike who works here now, who just like, I just love the way he dressed, you know, and he sits in now on clothing meetings. I know that between myself and all these people, we will figure out whether or not something's cool, like whether or not it works.
Does it have to be cool? I mean, is cool the operating factor?
No, definitely not. I think it's probably the wrong word, because we're intentionally kind of geeky. We're kind of geek hip. That's the way to put it.
But you're coming up with something that people can embrace and enjoy and also feel emotionally connected to.
Yes.
But when you do this, you, as you say, you put out limited editions, and the next step has to be something that's equal to or better than. Does this put a lot of pressure on you?
Or different than.
Or different than.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's more like, oh, it's over here. But it's true, the bar gets raised. The answer is yes, there's pressure, I guess. But the thing is that so far hasn't been difficult. I would say that the creative process isn't something that I ever sweat. I'm very impatient. When I do creative meetings, you know, we'll give 15 or 20 minutes to come up with an idea. And if it's not happening, we'll just try the next day. you know, a lot of the time I think about creatively, I think about alchemy. Traditionally, you would put all these materials together and then you make it really hot and something would emerge that's different than the two materials, metaphorically, like lead and other stuff.
Shit and gold.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, what I do is we put people in a room together, the creative group that's working on something, and I give them 15 minutes, and I really don't, and I just keep pushing people and push, and something usually pops out. And I'm pretty inventive, so I'm pretty good at guiding things.
You're pushing, and you're not stressed, but do you put stress on others?
Absolutely. I guess I do because, you know, working on this book, and so I had this guy who's helping me with it go and talk to my staff when I wasn't there. And apparently I've made almost everyone in this office cry at some point, but I have no idea. I just thought I'm like doing my thing, you know, but my standards are pretty intense.
Well, when I walked into the waiting room, which is a joy to walk into, much better than a doctor's office, I noticed behind curtains on your wall, although the curtains are open, is every day of the month. Every month of the year, there's something that has to come out. How does that volume get perpetuated? Are there any holidays?
No. No, and the thing is, it gets perpetuated because, I don't know how to put this, but I think that we're a company that really has like an open heart in a way. If someone comes to us with a great idea, we'll work with them to use it. Sometimes we see an artist and we're like, oh my God, this is like so great. And we're all out in the world. So we may run into someone and just go, oh, let's do something together and see what comes out of it. And things invariably come out of it. There was literally no, besides myself and Chad a little bit, but no, there's really no full-time creative staff here. We're all doing it all the time. And things just sort of emerge. If you were to look at our board, you'd see that we have designs. Now, we change them a lot by the time they get there, but we have designs marked on the board for the next 2 years ahead. A lot of the times, by the time we get there, it doesn't feel right anymore, something's changed, but there's just plenty of stuff.
It would seem that planning 2 years out and being in a cutting edge, for lack of a better word, is problematic, no matter how you cut it.
If you were to stick with the schedule.
If you were to stick with the schedule. So you started with toys, and now very vociferously you're moving into fashion and hoodies and sweatshirts and t-shirts and hats and all that stuff. How is this transition made?
Well, I guess the funny thing is, to me, it doesn't feel like that much of a transition. When we got to apparel, I discovered that it was real great to get a few people who like actually knew what they were doing. With toys, it took us longer, it felt like, because we didn't know what we were doing, we were making it up. To our benefit, actually. It was almost really the same thing. I found Jean, who does our women's clothing. We started with men's stuff, and now we're really doing wovens and leather jackets and knitwear and everything.
And was this a hard business to break into? I mean, there's a whole avenue devoted to fashion.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. No, I mean, we had done some toys with Barney's, so I just called up my friends at Barney's, and they said, show them what we were doing, and they said, we totally love it. So we're on our fourth season with Barney's right now, and so we sort of hopped right in at the top. The decision was, at first, just to keep it in our stores and at Barney's, and then now we're in like stores like Colette as well, and now we're sort of slowly expanding and letting a few stores each season. In fact, this is the first season we're doing Magic trade because our line is now getting to be so much more mature.
Because you do so many limited editions, you have to control the output of these things. You know, supply and demand, you don't want to become overly popular, right?
Well, no, I think we can be as popular as we're going to be just as long as I always produce a little less than the demand. I mean, on the business side, that's how I think about it. The way I think about it is that part of the value in what we're creating is that the people who are buying our stuff are forced to invest part of themselves in order to get what we have. So there isn't very much of it, or there's less than the demand. So you may have to wait in line to buy something at our stores. You may have to hunt for what we have, you know, on the rack at some store that's, you know, not Bloomingdale's and not Macy's, and certainly not like Target or Walmart. So when the customer invests some of themselves in order to actually buy something, there's extra value that's created. I think it's tangible. It's like subjective.
Do you ever feel the urge to break into the Walmart or Target or mass market media? I mean, people, I'm sure, are banging at your doors.
Yeah, and the answer is it has to work. I mean, meaning it has to be something that is created for that kind of a thing. And Walmart, I don't have any urge to go anywhere near Walmart, and I actually find distinction between Walmart and Target in that Target has 2% heart and Walmart has no heart. And the difference between 2% and none is infinite. So I really like... So in fact, we've actually just really recently created a toy that we're intending to kind of go further out, more just because I want to touch more people with it. But I'm not sure whether or not it's going to end up in that venue.
Well, when you say touch more people, why do you want to touch more people with it?
Actually, I think the toy just calls for it. There's something about it that feels like... it's this toy, Peekle, that we created that's... it's like Kid Robot's Playmobil, in a way. And there are these little characters that are in your neighborhood, but they're like, you know, a jogger in his underwear with an afro, and it's like this, but there's a spaceman, or there's the construction worker with a sunburn, you know, and there's something so funny, and there's an Eskimo. You know, the stuff that's like all very kind of real and tangible about it, and when you look at them, they just feel like they just want to be everywhere in the world. So we decided that that's needed, that that needs to happen.
So you're thinking about a wider market. You're doing toys on a regular basis. You're doing all the fashion. I presume you're thinking ahead to the next level, right?
Yes.
You want to share?
Well, we're opening more stores, which is really fun for me because all the stores look different.
Are you designing all the stores, or are you bringing in collaborators?
So far, I've pretty much designed all the stores. And I'd say there's collaboration involvement. Like, we collaborated with Abrico on the New York store. So it's collaboration on all of them, but every time I try to... I have this fantasy that I'll find an architect who really will come up with something really amazing that I won't even have to touch, because fundamentally I loved it. I love when that happens, and it just hasn't happened. The answer is, yeah, I've pretty much designed most of the stores so far, and when we go forward, we're kind of looking at some new people.
Have you thought of asking some of your toy people to design stores and some of your fashion people to design other things? I mean, mix and match?
Yeah, no. It's sort of a personality thing, you know? I mean, the answer is, like, what I want for the stores for, like, our website is a very elegant white box with parts that can change a lot, so that what's in there, which is so bright and ridiculous and colorful, really can pop out. So what I want from the stores is, it probably doesn't really necessarily require what a lot of the more Baroque artists I work with bring. So what I've been looking for is for, you know, designers for the stores who can work actually in a very elegant, modern way, kind of see how I want to create preciousness. How the glass cases create preciousness, and how everything is put so that things feel special.
What about the locales of these stores? I mean, right now in New York, you're in Soho. You used to be in Santa Monica, but you're in L.A.
Right, I'm Melrose now.
Are you kind of going into areas that were traditionally more upscale? Or do you want to stay where you are in that middle world?
Well, I like middle upscale. Like, I mean, I wouldn't mind being on Fifth Avenue, but it doesn't feel like quite our customer. You know, we somehow managed to, through hard work, managed to keep a very broad spectrum of customers. I mean, we have $400 hoodies, and we have $50 t-shirts, and we have $7 toys, and we have $20,000 toys, and we have like a $17,000 diamond necklace in our New York store, which we've now sold 3. So, it's pretty cool. You know, I kind of want to sell to everybody. I don't want to have a real specific demographic. So the stores tend to live in places where a lot of tourists will go. We try to keep, because that keeps the, on the business side, it keeps people knowing about the company, and then they come back in to the website and other stuff. So Miami, we're opening up on South Beach. And we're looking in Chicago. We're looking at a store across from the new Marc Jacobs, and in Las Vegas. I don't know what we're going to do, but I want to do a solid gold store there. Like, I want the floors to be gold, and it's going to be different if we go there, because Vegas is so cheesy that in order to go there, I just have to really overdo it. And we're pretty close to, at least for a store in Harajuku, Tokyo, right now.
So I've always wanted to ask somebody that rules an empire how they wake up in the morning and feel like the world isn't on their shoulders.
The world... I don't know, it doesn't feel like it's an empire, and it doesn't feel like the world's on my shoulders. Again, I just kind of come to work and look and see what needs doing, and I do that. For me, the first 3 or 4 years of this company were an enormous struggle financially. I mean, on the business side, this is a very foolish company to create. Normally, the best thing to do is you design the perfect hammer, and you keep making it for 100 years, and you sell it as mass as possible. Where we have to redesign the wheel all the time. I mean, you know, to make the molds we make to make 500 pieces of a toy, we could easily make 5 million pieces from the same, maybe a million from the same mold, and make a lot of money if we sold them that way. But at the same time, I think what I'm doing resonates so much with who I am, and I don't really experience creative fear.
That was Paul Budnitz, and this
is Steve Heller for the Core 77 broadcast.